From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about one local woman's fight to stop her deportation.
She's going back to a country where two of her brothers were killed, where she faces herself being kidnapped. So it's a lot to take in.
Then we'll learn if a Wisconsinite found love on Fox's reality dating show, Farmer Wants a Wife.
I think love is the whole purpose of life, so you got to put it out there and risk it a little bit. But I definitely had some hesitations going into it.
Plus, we'll learn about the local restaurants that have closed and some new ones in town. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. We'll start with the check-in. It's WUWM's segment, keeping up with the voices from Milwaukee's changing immigrant landscape. This week, we're looking at one specific story. Yesenia Ruano, the mother of two and MPS teacher's aide, has been outspoken about fighting her own deportation to El Salvador. Last week, she was ordered to leave the United States. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez is joined by Ruano's attorney, Mark Christopher, to learn about her case.
I was just hoping that you could give us an update on your client, Yesenia Ruano.
Yeah, we had really devastating news today. She was told that she is supposed to leave the country by June 3rd or she face arrest. And it's really devastating because Yesenia has ingrained her and her family, have ingrained herself in our Milwaukee community, and they do so much. And to get this news today is really devastating.
And you talked to Yesenia before we jumped on our call. What is going on in her mind right now? Where is she at?
I think she's still trying to process everything. What people don't realize is Yesenia has a T visa that's pending. And a T visa is for people who have been the victims of human trafficking. And traditionally what's happened before this administration is, while it's pending, you were able to remain in the United States to have your application decided. And here we're sending her back to the very country she's claiming that she's afraid of returning to. That's devastating for her, and it's devastating for her two girls and devastating for her husband. She's going back to a country where two of her brothers were killed, where she faces herself being kidnapped. So it's a lot to take in.
I think the thing that was really striking is that it feels like a whole part of the city really took to Yesenia and her story. But who is, for folks who don't know, who is Yesenia and how did she get to Milwaukee?
She is a wonderful human being. She is a teacher's aide. She is a caring mother. She is a wife. She is very active in her church. Overall, just has this incredibly optimistic disposition about her. She came to the United States approximately 14 years ago when she was fleeing violence in her home country, and two of her brothers were killed. She sought asylum in the U.S. She ultimately had her case dismissed, but was allowed to remain here while she applied for what's called a T visa. And during this time is when we've seen a change in administration. And we went from a policy of allowing people to have this application run its course and have a decision on it. And then at the end of that decision, then if it was positive, they get to stay. If it's negative, then they have to go back. But they're now, we're not waiting for the current administration is not allowing people to get the decision. So they're sending them back to the country that the very country that they're claiming fear from.
I guess the question I have for you there is, how does she even get on ICE's radar? Because no criminal record, as you said, applied for this pending T visa, was going about it, the whole process, quote unquote, the right way. This right. is a visa that's historically been protected from deportation. So how does this happen?
Yeah. So her case is somewhat unique in the sense that when she first attempted to enter into the United States, she didn't affirmatively say, I'm afraid of going back. She was quickly processed in a very rushed manner and given something called an expedited removal. And an expedited removal has the same effect as a deportation. But she was sent back immediately. She again faced the same type of danger, returned to the United States. And this time She stated right at the beginning when she came in that she feared returning. She was interviewed and an asylum officer determined that she had a credible fear of returning. So she was paroled in, but she was paroled in with a deportation order. She went to immigration court and the judge at that time indicated this may not meet the exact qualifications for a withholding claim, but you sound like you have a strong T visa case. And right now they're not deporting anyone. So we're not going to enter in a denial on your case. We're going to dismiss the case and allow you to pursue the T visa. Of course, that was during the Biden administration where there was no real concern that she would be removed, that she would be able to file her T visa and let that run its course. And then, of course, you had the election in November and there's just been a 180 turn in policy on the way that these cases are handled.
And this has resulted in some people being very public and outspoken, even in the face of being really vulnerable with their status, which Yesenia was. She took a very bold approach, publicly fought court orders, ICE's potential deportation. Can we talk about her approach and what was so different about that, even in the face of this 180 policy change?
Right. Most people are very scared to come forward and share their story because they feel vulnerable and they think it's going to make them susceptible to being targeted and deported. Yesenia took a very open and honest approach in allowing people in to what her life is like, her daily life as a teacher, as a mother, as a member of the community. And she showed exactly who she was. And that's the wonderful human being you're reading about in the many articles and you're seeing on in the interviews. She's very genuine. She's very open. And that takes a lot of courage to do that. And while her story, she may end up being removed, her value has come in opening people's eyes to what the immigrant plight is like, how terrible it is in, you know, Central American countries, why we need to listen to these stories and to also demonstrate what an unbelievable positive impact immigrants have on our community.
You know, you got to the point that she's also a mother and has this family, and her twin daughters both turn 10 this week. What does this order mean for her daughters and for her family?
Yeah, it's tough. It means that they're going to have to spend at least the next 8 years of their life in a third world country and subject to violence, subject to poverty, subject to substandard education and medical care. That's going to be their life for the next 8 years. You know, they're 10 years old. They're involved in so many extracurricular activities in school. I think one of them plays the violin. The other one's into arts and crafts. And so those opportunities that we U.S. citizens take for granted for our children, they're no longer going to have. And it was funny, we were talking before the hearing today. She was concerned about the process of getting their dog down to Central America should she have to go back, because there was no way that they would be able to get their daughters to go down there without their beloved dog. So we were talking about what that process was like. So it's definitely a sobering day for us in the immigration world.
You had mentioned if she would have to go back. What comes next for Yesenia?
Yeah, the only potential avenue she has left, and it's really a Hail Mary, is to file one last stay of removal. Given the fact that she now has the receipts for the T visa, in other words, it's been formally accepted by the Department of Homeland Security. That's a new factor. That's something new that wasn't available before when she had checked in. So there's a potential of filing a stay based off of that new factor. But to be honest with you, it's a real Hail Mary. She has a flight booked out of Chicago for the 3rd to go back home. And right now she's planning on going.
All right, Mark. Well, thank you so much for this update. And I'm sure we'll be checking in as things go forward, too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Christopher is Yesenia Ruano's attorney, a local woman who's being deported. Christopher spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez for WUWM series The Check-In. This reporting is part of WUWM's focused, in-depth coverage on three issues our community told us they care about: climate change, immigration, and the economy. You can find more coverage on immigration at WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll look at some of the local restaurants that have closed and learn about new ones coming to town. But first, we'll speak with a Madison native who recently appeared on the reality dating show Farmer Wants a Wife. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. How far would you go for love? Wisconsin's Karina Sable saddled up and joined Fox's reality dating show Farmer Wants a Wife in hopes of a rural romance. On the show, four farmers from across the country are set up with a crop of single women from big cities to show them life on the farm. The season 3 finale aired recently, and Sable was one of two women left vying for Farmer Jay Wood's heart.
I got the butterflies, the nerves, all the good things.
Karina, very beautiful, very sweet, and she has that work ethic.
I'm glad you noticed it.
You can tell she got a good energy by the way she just kind of pranced off.
Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez spoke with Sable about her decision to join the show and what her journey to find love on the farm was like.
Karina, you were one of the ladies vying for Farmer Jay's heart on Farmer Wants a Wife, but I want to start from the beginning. Can you tell our listeners about yourself and how you ended up on the show?
So I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. That's where I was raised, and I moved back there after graduating college. My best friend lived there as well at the time when I was applying, and she was like, you should apply for Love Island. And I was like, no, that show is not my realm or anything I really agree to. But I was like, but I have heard about this show, Farmer Wants a Wife, so I'll sign up for this. You can sign up for Love Island. And so we both just like kind of went out on a whim thinking it was kind of like a joke, whatever. And we applied and I got a text back. And there I was continuing the process along and ended up in Alabama.
Oh, my God. I got a text, literally.
Literally. I sent it to my other friend who's, like, obsessed with reality TV. I was like, is this real? But it was.
So you get the text. What made you think dating a farmer and the lifestyle that comes with it might be for you?
So I grew up with a family farm. We've had, over the years, horses, cows, cats, dogs. My sisters have chickens, ducks, like that whole realm. So it's not too far-fetched, especially in the Madison area. There's still like a big focus on ag and farmers. And I also have always like admired the farming lifestyle. Very admirable to me in the sense that they're hardworking. They have the grit. They have probably more traditional values and like want to settle down. But I kind of was like, oh, you know, there's nothing too bad that could come from this opportunity. So I went along with it.
It's kind of like you really had an open mind going into this.
Totally. And I truly believe that there's not a bad opportunity with this or a bad experience, either talking to someone over the phone and interviewing. You know, you gain skills from that side of things. So I was just kind of along for the ride.
Okay, so as we talked about, you matched with Farmer Jay Woods, who's a cattle rancher in rural Alabama. Can you explain the process of how each lady is matched with one of the four farmers?
So it's kind of like a dating app. Once you get through the general interview process with the producers, they would send you an email with little clips, probably about a minute and a half, of different farmers. And they were ranked like Farmer A, Farmer B, Farmer C, and so on. After you watch the videos, you're supposed to send back descriptions as to why you think you would be a good match, why you wouldn't be a good match, if you would go on the show if you were matched with them. And then you rank, let's say there's five every time. Every time you would rank 1 to 5. And then we went through that process probably 7 or 8 times. Wow. With different farmers. Some would come back, some would go away, kind of just getting a good variation of what farmers and what your type is. And then occasionally the producers would call you and just say like, hey, I think you would really match with this person. Would you be up for it? And then you kind of have that kind of conversation and so on. So that's the girl's side. the guy side, they have, I believe, all like 100 applicants of women. And then they have to dwindle their way down. But they don't get video clips. They just get one photo and a quick description of us.
And what was it about Farmer Jay's profile that caught your eye?
So Farmer Jay, right off the bat, he definitely had some like general characteristics that I usually look for in a guy. Usually is athletic or has that competitive side. He played football at Michigan, and so that originally kind of caught my eye too, being a part of the Midwest culture for a little bit. And then he talked about family and faith and all those good things. So that kind of intrigued me right off the bat. And then as the season went on, we just kind of kept building our friendship and relationship.
So I feel like the moments that I noticed where your relationship with Jay grew were honestly kind of during the more stressful times. You know, at some point there was some beef between the ladies, and at another time, Jay brought another girly on the farm. But what I appreciated about you is that you were really open and honest with him about your feelings, and you didn't really hold back. Can you talk more about this?
Yeah, I definitely went into the show already having dating experience, right? So all of college, all of high school, all that, and post-college as well. And what I've learned from those dating experiences is I really have to take someone's word for what they are. And so I can't assume anything. I can't, like, stress out about what he's saying to someone else. And so that's kind of the mentality I went into the show with. And during those times that you mentioned, I kind of told myself right off the bat, like, I had to be as open as I would want him to be. And so that kind of starts with communicating. So I'm going to say how I am feeling. I hope that he explains his side of it. And then we can kind of have a conversation moving forward with it. At the barn dance, we definitely had a little bit of drama on our farm, but it ended pretty quickly. And I think the thing with that scenario specifically was I actually really appreciated that us girls were able to handle it without bringing in someone else, right?
For sure.
I'm totally in the idea and mindset that, like, if you have an issue with me, just come and talk to me about it, and we're not going to make it a bigger thing, and we can talk about it. I was raised in a house with four other girls, my sisters and my brother, and that's kind of how we were raised to behave. So I appreciated in that moment that we were able to talk it through. And then once we talk it through, it's dropped and you move on. And I think that's a skill that you have to learn. But after that whole tiff thing, Jay and I ended up having a great night hanging out together while maybe it didn't go that way for others.
And so, like you mentioned, you were one of Farmer Jay's final two daters. How are you feeling leading up to the finale?
So the finale actually came up really quick. From the time that my family came to visit and meet Jay and I met his family, it was within 48 hours.
Wow.
And so I have a lot of, like, pride for my family, and I'm really lucky to have them in my back corner. And so I was really excited to have them meet him and then also meet his family, because I know family is important to him. So we were definitely on a high. And after our families met, got to go on like one final date. Everything was good. But I also knew, and I think my sister mentions it on the show, there is concern leading up to that as to why he hadn't figured out who he wanted yet. And so at that point going into it, I was kind of expecting for myself to have hesitation if I was going to be the one, because I don't think anyone deserves to be like a second choice, especially on something so important as love. Like, I want you to jump 2 feet in, not 1 foot, and maybe teeter there.
Like, we are picking each other. You are there for me. Not
totally.
Like, I don't know. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it has to be a two-way street. And I don't regret it by any means. I think love is the whole purpose of life. So you got to put it out there and risk it a little bit. But I definitely had some hesitations going into it, expecting the worst, and not even that the worst was really that bad.
And I guess spoiler incoming, but we kind of spoiled it. During the season finale, Jay ultimately asked his other dater, Grace, if she'd like to continue their relationship. What was going through your mind when Jay was letting you know he was moving forward with Grace?
I believe I mentioned it, and I was really happy that Jay was using his heart and just general logic. I think on paper, he and I both felt like we really matched with the athletic, the family focus, even faith. And I think the whole time he was teetering because on paper we matched so well. And all I kept asking him for the last few days was just go with your heart, because that's never going to lead you wrong. And if it doesn't end up perfect, that's okay. You're going to learn a lesson. And so I was really appreciative that he mentioned that and kind of stood his ground there. And there's nothing wrong with following your heart.
Right. Reflecting on everything that's happened, what would you say your biggest takeaway was from this dating experience?
I think there are a few, but one of the major ones is I'm extremely proud of myself for being able to handle a situation like that. I think if you would have asked me to go on that show 2 years ago, I would have been like crazy and so insecure and not really sure what my values were or what I'm really focusing on. But the show definitely forces you to really think about like what really matters, and what at the end of the day matters to me is loving someone who also loves me, my family, my friends who will go to bat for me. All of those things really matter, and the rest is just icing on the cake. So being able to be in that scenario when you don't have your phone, you don't really have a ton of access to TV and things like that, and you really are in a place where you're kind of alone with your thoughts at times, I'm proud that I was able to handle that and come out on the other side really well.
Do you feel like it changed your perspective on dating and who you date?
I know this is really controversial because my family tells me it all the time, but I've really solidified that I do want to get married soon, and I want to do it with the right person, so I'm not going to force it, but I do kind of date to marry at this point. And I know I'm young and there's so much that can change, but I want to go into a relationship with the intent for a possible future, and I hope that that person who dates me also goes in with that same intent.
And I like that. I like that you know what you want, and I think that'll be good and healthy for you in your future relationships.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
So I guess what's next for you now that the show is over?
So it was definitely a weird feeling coming back, because by the time we ended up finishing filming, that was the first week of November. And so our names and anything about the show weren't released until mid-February. So I was kind of just like waiting around because I couldn't go on the dating apps and, you know, start a relationship and be like, oh, I actually was gone on TV for a couple months or a couple weeks. So I was definitely in limbo. And then once our names got released, then I once again was still in that same predicament that it would ruin the story if someone saw me. So I've kind of just been waiting for the finale to air, and now I'm back out in the world ready to date and traveling a lot, trying to see different cultures, different communities, see if there's a right fit somewhere else. But I love Wisconsin and I love Madison too.
Before we wrap up, I'd love to end by asking you, what's your advice for anyone out there looking for love right now?
My advice, and I live by this, is there truly isn't life without love, so risk it. There's nothing worse than being told no, but it's the only way you're going to know. And just ask the questions that you want to ask, and you'll either save time in the long run, or you'll be like super happy with the answer and be able to build a stronger bond.
Wow. Well, Karina, thanks so much for chatting with me today. I really loved learning more about you and your time on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. This was great.
Karina Sable is from Madison, and she was a dater on Fox's reality dating show Farmer Wants a Wife. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. You can now stream the full season 3 of Fox's Farmer Wants a Wife on Hulu. As summer quickly approaches, many of us are looking for new places to dine out here in Milwaukee. Lori Frederick is on top of it. Frederick is the dining editor for On Milwaukee, and she regularly joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about some of the latest restaurants in Milwaukee and to look back at some of the beloved restaurants that have recently closed.
So it has been a minute since we've spoken, and a lot has happened in that time. I think we're going to start today with looking at some of the restaurants that have left Milwaukee pretty recently. The first one we're going to talk about, a favorite of mine, it was, in fact, I I think, many restaurants inside of one space, Crossroads Collective.
Yeah. And Crossroads just very recently closed. And they're closing to make way for a new concept called Naughty Plates, which is an Italian concept. And that sort of serendipitously came through and was looking at properties that belong to Newland. And Newland is like, well, we do have this food hall. She walked in. It piqued her interest. And they decided, I think, to cut their losses. So Crossroads is interesting because it came on full blast kind of right before the pandemic. Very popular, like some really good spots. Even through the pandemic, lots and lots of carryout, you know, was transacted during that time. And then we moved away from those years. And the East Side is kind of going through one of its phases. And I don't know how else to describe those, because if you've been around the East Side, you know how it's this really interesting up and down kind of ecosystem where things are really, really popular and up for a while. And sometimes, I don't know, they wane for a little while. It's really what happened at Crossroads is it came out of the pandemic and the formula just didn't seem to go right.
Not too far away, although a very different kind of reason for why they closed, the Lafayette Place.
This is such an interesting intersection is really what it's about is because going back to, I think the furthest that I remember was Abu's being on that street corner. But almost every single restaurant that has been on that street corner has had some sort of accident. Most have been a car crashing into a building. This is another one of those situations where the Lafayette Place sustained a pretty serious injury to the foundation and the front of the building. But the repairs, the extent to which it took to make those happen this time, took longer than they should have. And these days, it's really, you know, for restaurants, time is huge. So the Lafayette Place ended up giving up that space. Although there is a new place coming in, Temple Goddess Cafe, which was in the Crossroads Collective right down the road. And they will replace Lafayette Place with another vegan concept, which is good news.
Another place that is closed, also on the East Side, although I'd say more the Lower East Side, Cathedral Square, I guess. This is it. I think they were the oldest gay bar in Milwaukee.
Absolutely. And maybe even in the state. I think this is one of those situations, too, where it's been a long time. You know, somebody has taken on that. I think they've threatened to close a couple of times before, mostly due to finances, and have always been able to come back around again. And I think this time it's just a matter of it's been a lot of years. It's a tough business, and it's going to close. But it's kind of a shame. Well, we'll have the rainbow on the sidewalk near the...
There's that. So on the other side of this, we've had a lot of different restaurants that have opened recently in the Milwaukee area, including this first one. I've actually been to this restaurant. It is Knee Burmese.
Yes. And what'd you think?
I really enjoyed it.
It's a beautiful space.
Beautiful.
Number one.
The art is very cool inside of it.
Yeah, they have like the little puppets.
Mm-hmm. And beautiful masks.
And beautiful masks, yes. All over the walls. I mean, culturally, there are stories upon stories about everything that you encounter in the restaurant. And then secondly, we really don't have Burmese food to any extent here in Milwaukee. Well, we didn't.
We didn't.
And now we do.
But we have so many Burmese people.
And I was going to say, and I think our Burmese population far exceeds, you know, what we have in terms of representation of the food. For anyone who doesn't know Burmese food, Indian food, Thai food, Chinese food, they all have elements that are common. There's a lot of those influences on the dishes. And yet Burmese food has somehow managed to remain unique and of its own. So I was really, really happy to see this place come to pass.
The next one is a style of restaurant or style of menu maybe that I hadn't heard of before. The restaurant is called 1033 Omakase. Is that right?
Yes. It's a beautiful little place. For those who might remember, this was, it's been a few things, but it was probably Laughing Taco for the longest. It's a tiny little restaurant. I think it probably has 14 bar seats, 12 to 14 bar seats. And right now, I think they're seating 8 to 10 per seating, for an omakase seating. I believe there's 2 per evening. And so they are sold out. You literally, at the end of every month, they open up the seating for a month from now. So you kind of have to get on that to get in. Part of it is because it's just simply so small. But they pack it full of people twice a day, you know, for 5 days a week. They're doing really, really delicious food. That isn't something, we have never seen something quite like this. So omakase is a Japanese coursed menu. And mostly, for the most part, they're small, bite-sized courses. These, for instance, are 14-course menus. But it's not the type of a 14-course menu where you're going to get out of it and you're going to feel like you need to eat again. Nor is it one of those 14-course meals where you're going to come out at the end and feel like you need to sleep. because the food is much lighter. It's very well paced. There is a level of entertainment that kind of comes with this. It's basically you're being served by the chef who is preparing all of the food. And there, you know, there are spritzes of edible glitter and, you know, there's the charring of fish. And so if you are interested in a meal that is a little bit more than just sitting and eating, you'll enjoy omakase.
Now, another place that has opened, actually kind of on the opposite side of the city, Kinship.
Yes. So Kinship is in Bronzeville, and it's in the old, I told you, the Bosansor Schuster's building. And there were three entities who came together to basically rebuild the building. There is a lot of healthcare right now in the building itself. And a lot of different businesses have inhabited that space. But when they were looking for like a coffee shop or a place for people to sit and commune, have meetings, have lunch, they came upon Kinship. And Kinship is a concept that was created by the River West Food Pantry. I believe they've actually adjusted their name at this point to better describe their mission, because they're doing a lot more things than being a food pantry. I mean, they have a farm. They also do a lot of counseling. And one of the things they do is job-related counseling. So Kinship is comprised entirely of a group of folks who are, I think, on 16, 17-month appointments in new jobs, where they are kind of learning and getting back into the workforce. So what you're doing when you eat at Kinship is you're supporting these folks and kind of getting those skills that they need to go out back out in the world and make the money that they need to provide for their families. And you're supporting this as an ongoing project. The rehabilitation that they're doing there is really, really great. The energy in the space is just pretty amazing. And the food is good, too. And if you miss the fried chicken from Tandem, there's a fried chicken sandwich that is basically made along those same veins.
Now, coming to the Milwaukee area very soon are a couple of restaurants that I think people are pretty excited about. One that I keep hearing about is, of course, Ruby's Bagels. If you have been to Zocalo on the south side, I think they still have a van there. I'm not positive about that, but
I've definitely
been to the van.
I think they've been occasionally off weeks to kind of get prepared for the new bakery. So I believe that they signed the lease on this bakery. I think it's been just a little bit more than a year. Daniela Varela, who owns Ruby's Bagels, is self-financing this entire project. And so she's had a lot before her. And she wanted it to be the bakery that she had always dreamed about, you know, on the first time out. And that's hard to do, especially when you're on a budget. And the really great thing about Ruby's is it is absolutely a story of somebody who decided, I'm going to go do this thing. And when Daniela first began with bagels, you know, she ate a bagel and said, I can do this. I want to do this. And she took that concept of making bagels, something she'd never done before. She went back to the kitchen and she spent months figuring it out. And she ended up with some pretty darn good bagels that basically helped to put Milwaukee on the map. Milwaukee was not a bagel town in any way, shape, or form. She did the early hours. She worked a second job. She got a food truck. And what she really wanted was her own bakery where she could go do, for sure, bagels. In fact, it's interesting because she has one of the former Harder's bakeries on the west side. And so it's kind of a cool space. It's a classic bakery that people know as a bakery, and she's kind of bringing that spirit back.
Now, the final restaurant we're going to look at, I Googled the restaurant without Milwaukee, and I learned the name of what I thought was a weed in my garden, but is apparently quite useful. Purslane is both the name of this plant and also a new restaurant.
Yeah, purslane. I thought it was a weed for many, many years, too. And then, and a friend of mine actually picked it up off the ground and pulled it up and said, eat this. And I was like, are you serious? Like, is this a joke? She's like, no. She's like, it's delicious. And that is true. And I have high hopes, actually, for purslane, the restaurant, insofar as being delicious as well. Mary Castman is the head of purslane. She's had a lot of different experiences. She's worked with Luke Zahm at his Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, which has been lauded with James Beard nods. But she's also worked out in Boston. And when she was out in Boston is where she fell in love with Turkish food, which really forms the theme for purslane. And she will be making all sorts of Turkish small plates, large plates. I think her two emphases are, number one, very farm-to-table, very seasonal, and this notion of kind of shared ingredients, you know, across the world, this idea that we can make food and give honor to food that's across the world with the ingredients that we have here, you know, rather than necessarily shipping them globally. But the other finer point for purslane is to gather people together for social meals and this idea of shareable cuisine that has a social factor is definitely part of the idea.
Very nice. Well, hopefully a summer full of great food here in Milwaukee ahead of us.
For sure.
Lori, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
Lori Frederick is the dining editor for On Milwaukee, and she regularly joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about dining in the city. At WUWM.com, you can find some of their previous conversations about Milwaukee area restaurants. We've got a new season of Bulber Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've always wondered about at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll learn about the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion and the Milwaukee woman who served in it. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee's Anna Mae Robertson, one of the last surviving members of the famed 6888 unit, has died at the age of 101. Robertson was among the 855 women in the 68th 88th Central Postal Directory Battalion, a predominantly Black, all-female unit stationed overseas during World War II. Their job was clearing a nearly three-year logjam of mail. Marquette University Lubar Center's director, Derek Mosley, had the opportunity to meet Robertson at her 98th birthday party, and we spoke in February of last year about the 6888 and more Black history, starting with the fireman's pole. We're going to talk about a couple of topics of note that are, you know, generally of service, things that have helped us in the past and continue to have an influence on us today. So to start, we're going to kick things off with the fire pole.
Yeah.
People might not think about this unless maybe since a class field trip that they had in grade school.
Yeah. So we're going to take you to Chicago, 90 miles south. There was a firehouse. It's the 1800s. So it's a firehouse number 21 in Chicago. There's a captain of that firehouse by the name of David Kenyon. And the way firehouses were laid out back then, on the bottom floor was the wagon and horses because it was horse-drawn. Second floor was sleeping arrangements, and third floor were the hay for the horses. So they used to have regular stairs, and the horses are smart. And so the horses would walk up the stairs and eat the hay. So they decided to remove the walk-up stairs and make a spiral staircase because horses are smart but not that smart. And so they had a spiral staircase, but not knowing that having a spiral staircase and also at night makes it really slow because the sleeping quarters are on the top level. So when a fire happened, the firefighters would run down the spiral staircase and get on the horses and take off. Well, one of the battalions, number 21, the fire battalion, was always getting to the fires first. And the way it worked in the 1800s is the first team on the scene got paid.
Mm.
Everybody else did not get paid.
Competitive incentive.
Absolutely.
Right there. Yeah.
Absolutely. So this Firehouse 21 was at all the fires, no matter where they were, before everybody else. So the chief decided he would check and see what happened. And they got called out to a fire. He went into the house, and he noticed that they had removed the spiral staircase and had put in this wooden pole. It was a wooden pole that they used to move the hay on the top level. And they just lacquered it up, and they would slide down from their beds right down to the bottom, get out, and be the first to the fire, making all the money. And so once he saw that, he realized that it was a pretty good idea, and that was the birth of the fire pole.
We can thank Captain David Kenyon for that.
Absolutely. And then, of course, Boston made it brass, and then the brass pole's there. And now they don't really use them anymore, but it's still a nice little piece of history that came from Black history.
Yeah, and I think it's still a quintessential image we think of when we think of firehouses.
Yeah, yeah. And now they're building firehouses all on one level because you don't need to store hay anymore. And so they don't need really a fire pole, but they still have them in the houses because, you know, kids like to see them.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are going to go forward in history a bit. So we're going to go from the 1870s to about 1945. The U.S. is in World War II for about 4 years at this point. And we are going to talk about the 6888.
Yes.
Postal Directory Battalion.
Yeah, so the 6888th was their official term, and they were the Postal Directory Battalion, as you mentioned. And so let's just set the stage for a minute. So it's the war, and soldiers are dispatched all over Europe, and they're traveling to different cities, different places. But people are still mailing them things like cards and cookies and cakes and things of that nature. But because of the transitory nature of the soldiers, they weren't at the same place at all at the same time. So they had these warehouses that were just full of mail. I mean, when I say full, if you Google, you know, the mail house, you'll see these bags of
sacks
mail.
And sacks.
Sacks and sacks of mail in these warehouses.
Big hangers, too.
Right. Yeah. It's crazy. And they put big ships in them that now have mail in it. And so they decided to start this unit, the 6888, or as you mentioned, the 6888s. And it was a predominantly Black, because sometimes you see it says all Black. There were two Latinas in the unit. So it's predominantly Black, but all women of color. Unit, the first only that was deployed to Europe to take care of that backlog. And so they were shipped off to Birmingham, England. They got into the warehouses. The warehouses didn't have heat. It was the winter. They were dimly lit. They were fighting off rats and roaches and all these other things.
Plus that threat of air raids all
the
time.
Oh, yeah. Never mind the fact that bombs are being dropped on you. But, of course, I go right to the rats and roaches.
Right. Overall, inhospitable working conditions.
Inhospitable, right.
Yeah.
And so they decided they would split up into three units, and those three shifts, I should say, would process this mail. Each shift would process about 65,000 pieces of mail each shift. And they would run them. And what's so crazy about this is they would catalog everybody's name and their serial numbers. And so when they cataloged those names, there were like over 7,000 Robert Smiths, right? So you have all these Robert Smiths, you have all this mail, you have to make sure the right Robert Smith gets it. And they categorized all these people, all their mail, to make sure the mail went out. They had this cool motto, no mail, low morale. And they kept saying that to themselves, no mail, low morale. And they took care of that backlog. 17 million pieces of mail they processed.
And the government was anticipating that this problem with this unit could be fixed in about 6 months, but it only took them three.
3 months, and he knocked it out. And it's almost so good that they sent him off to France to do the same exact thing.
Too good. They even created, as you mentioned, created a new tracking system that made this new method and their unit so efficient.
Yeah, and you know what's also wild about it is the fact that they didn't have any guns. They weren't issued weapons. And so you have these women who are essentially soldiers. They've been trained as soldiers, and they're in these warehouses, and they're processing this mail, and all they have to defend themselves is what they learned in basic training, the karate or jujitsu they learned in basic training.
And as you mentioned, about 7 million pieces of mail sorted. They were under the command of Major Charity Adams.
Yes.
Want to give her a shout out.
Shout her out.
Yes.
As the first commissioned officer ever in the military. Yep.
Yeah. And how many women were approximately in this unit?
So there were 855 women who were part of the unit. And I think it's worth noting, Audrey, that after the war was over, or their service was over, they were sent back home, and the unit was just disbanded. There's no recognition, no medals. They were just disbanded. And it wasn't really until recently that people were made aware of them. But there are 855 women, I told you, made up of both Black and Latinas. And they processed all that mail with very little fanfare. And if you ever have an opportunity to see them on the internet, because of the 855, there's only four who are still remaining. And you could see them sometimes. You pull up a YouTube video, you could listen to them talk. And they just felt like a sense of pride to get this done, because it was a time of, you know, the time in history, a lot of division between the races, and a lot of people didn't think that Blacks were up to the task. And so they felt like they had the whole race on their backs trying to perform this, so they couldn't fail. And so they're great stories. And it's a little local twist to this as well, because we do have one member of the 6888s here in Milwaukee, Anna Mae Robertson, who is the sweetest. But she's fiery, but she's sweet.
You got to meet her?
I did get to meet her. So
what was that like?
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. So what happened is, I do those Facebook posts every February, one post a day for Black History Month. And her sister reached out to me because she saw the post on social media. And she said, I can't believe that you did this. This is so amazing. And my mom was one of these women. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I have to meet her. And, you know, it was right after COVID had happened. And so she says, well, we're having a birthday party for her. She was turning 98. And the mayor was coming to give her, make it Anna Mae Robertson Day or whatever it was.
Sure.
And so they asked me if I wanted to come. And of course. And so I went and I got to meet her. And she is absolutely amazing. You would never know, you know, talking to her, what they accomplished. Because, you know, you had to make sure the soldiers knew what they were fighting for. You know, you have these young kids who had probably never left their state they were from. Now they're in a different country with names of towns they probably couldn't even pronounce. And so home meant a lot. So if you could bring home to them, bring food to them, things that they remembered, it's for morale. And so she said that's all they thought about is the soldiers. And she is amazing. And it was so funny. Over Christmas, I got a Christmas card, and I opened up the Christmas card, and she had copied her, because they received a commendation just recently in 2022. And
yeah, in March. 2022.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the president, and shout out to Gwen Moore, because it was Gwen Moore who was the one to let everybody know that these women existed, and one was here in Milwaukee. And when she got the commendation, she sent me an invitation to the commendation, as well as a copy of it, like a photocopy of it. And I opened up in the Christmas card, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. And she signed it. And, you know, for me, this means so much because I follow Black history a lot. And so I'm sure my family hates it. Like, my kids probably hate it. But, you know, our vacations aren't like to cool places. Our vacations are
historical sites. Absolutely.
So it just meant a lot to have a piece of history and to actually touch and talk to people, because a lot of our heroes, and I mean our, meaning American heroes of African descent, aren't around anymore. And so it's important that we give them their flowers while they're alive.
Yeah, we see, as you mentioned, these historical images of accomplishments made in the past, but we need to take a look and remember it's not that long ago.
No, it really isn't that long ago, because we have a woman who was part of the World War II fight. And when they came home, they still fought discrimination, right? So you're fighting against tyranny abroad to come home to be treated like a second-class citizen. But they did it with pride, and their service was with pride. And I have so much love and respect for Anna May and all of the 6888s.
Yeah, much thanks to Anna May and the 6888s. And Derek, thank you so much, as always, for coming in to share history. We love it.
My pleasure. Thank you for allowing me to come and tell these stories.
Derek Mosley is the director of the Marquette University Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. We spoke in February of last year about the 6888 and Anna Mae Robertson, who passed away at the age of 101 on May 31st. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at wuwm.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll bring you a group chat all about Pride Month, and we'll look at Milwaukee Film's Pride Month programming. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.